The Florida Community of Mindfulness is happy to make these talks available to you. If you find this talk to be a benefit, please consider making a donation to support us. You'll find a donation button on the Talks section of our website, floridamindfulness.org. Thank you, and may you be happy and free of suffering.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for coming this morning. We do all have choices. And there are certainly other things we could be doing on a Sunday morning in Tampa Bay. So thank you for choosing to do this. So in the month of June, I think many of you know, we did a retreat. Up at Southern Dharma in North Carolina, mostly attended by people from here, from our community. And then recently I was in Colorado with seven other members of our community doing a 10-day solitary retreat at a retreat center in Southern Colorado. And I know last week there was a panel of four members who had been, two who had been on the retreat in Southern Dharma and two had been on the solitary retreat, talking somewhat about their experience. But what I wanted to talk about with you this morning is the kind of teachings and practices that are presented at what we call our wisdom path here. I say that because I think intellectually we can understand that developmental path, but I think because of our cultural baggage, the fact that we grow up in a culture where the ego and the self is so strongly imprinted in us at a very early age by our culture, by the way we're raised, etc., because we live in such a materialist culture, and also because that our major the major people who are charged with our mental health in our society are people who approach mental health from the point of view of ego and self. And Buddhist psychology comes at it such from a radically different way that I think even though we intellectually understand some of these things, we may not really get it. So I did want to talk a little bit, but because again, I think our wisdom path, while it can be intellectually understood, I want to spend a little time kind of giving a sense of what really goes on. And again, as most of you know, in our community, we have three paths. We call it the mindful living path, the Dharma path, and the wisdom path. And that really relates to a very sound way for people who want to heal and transform and awaken to do it in a very concrete and realistic and effective way. I think, unfortunately, what goes on a lot in our culture, our Buddhist culture these days, is things are very sporadic. People start here and they jump to there and then they go over there and then they read this and then they listen to this. So this kind of systematic presentation of developmental path, I think, is really very helpful to us. I think starting this week in our community for members, we have, I believe, four intensives going on. These are practice periods that involve nearly 140 people at the Mindful Living Path, the Dharma Path, and the Wisdom Path. The Mindful Living Path, just very simply, and again, I think it's very easily understood, is it's the foundation. You know, we need to first stabilize our minds. We could, go on to higher teachings and practices, but my experience is we will not really benefit from them. We will not receive the fruits of them because of the instability of our emotionality, the instability of our lives, the instability of our minds. So the mindful living path gives people an opportunity to learn how to just live mindfully, how to live in the present, and how to heal the emotional wounds or baggage that they are carrying that interfere and destabilize and create conflict in their lives. And it's very hard if there is ongoing instability and emotional ability and relationship conflict in one's life to think that somehow we're going to come to the meditation cushion and somehow our mind will be stable and solid is really, well, it's not going to happen. Because, see, unfortunately, even though we might have divided our mind up into all kinds of pieces, it really is only one mind. And so even though we may embark on the spiritual path, the path of transformation, and want to undertake various kinds of meditative practices, because the mind that is doing that is very much this very unstable, emotionally very afflictive kind of mind, that's the mind that we will end up practicing with. And that mind is not capable of really practicing. So first we need to stabilize ourselves in mindful living and stabilize ourselves in some sense of emotional stability, which comes through healing and comes through really knowing our emotional self and knowing how to be present to our emotional self and to heal and transform our emotional self. So that's, I'm not going to go into that today, but that's this, you know, that's where we begin. And many people who may come to our community, that's really what they want. And that's certainly beneficial. In a therapeutic way, it's very beneficial for people to involve themselves in the mindful living path. But some people kind of have a further aspiration, sort of what we might call a more spiritual, religious aspiration, where they really want to kind of understand what's going on in this world, what's going on within our minds, what's going on. And they're looking for a life of greater meaning that involves service and love. And you know what I mean? There are various things that now we want to develop. The first path is really just learning how to be present and learning how to heal the past. But now there are those who are ready to embark on some kind of journey. And that journey involves development of understanding, of compassion, of patience, of generosity, all various kinds of positive attributes, and really sort of understanding, you know, these fundamentals of Buddhism, such as impermanence, and learning to really understand that everything is changing. Learning to understand why things change the way they do, the law and cause and effect, karma. To really understand why we work so hard at finding happiness and meaning in life, and yet somehow it always seems to be elusive. No matter what we get or what we achieve, somehow inside that deeper sense of ease and well-being and happiness somehow doesn't stay with us more than an experience. So that's our Dharma path, okay? And we have many people involved in our Dharma path. And that's where we sort of get into the teachings about self. Right now we have an intensive going on called Deconstructing the Myth of Self, which is sort of radical because in our society, in our culture, professionally and just people like us, self is considered a very real central thing. In Buddhism, it's actually considered the source of our suffering. So that's the Dharma path. So then we have this wisdom path. And it doesn't mean that already in our practice of the mindful living path and a Dharma path, we haven't gotten wisdom, gotten some understanding. But it's been more cognitive, it's been more intellectual. At the wisdom path, we enter that tradition of Buddhism that has to do with direct realization, direct understanding. So obviously in the wisdom path, meditation, introspection, contemplation is much more central. Okay? Because now we're wanting to understand deeply our own minds, right? For most of us, most of our life, we've always been trying to understand what's going on out there. We've always tried to understand what's going on with this one or that one. Our view has always been out. But in Buddhism it says the central factor, that which is looking out into the world, is our mind. And so what is our mind? You see, so at the wisdom path we're really trying to understand things more deeply. So let me more practically talk about. So we had a seven-day retreat at Southern Dharma. It's an hour north up in the mountains, north of Asheville. Basically, wake up is at 6 o'clock. We begin, we end at 9:30 at night. And basically, during the day, the primary activity goes on in the meditation hall. There's meditation, guided, unguided. There are talks by the teacher. There are opportunities for mindful movements in the afternoon. There's a period what we call deep listening, deep sharing, where the whole community of practitioners get together and sort of share their experiences for the last 24 hours at retreat. We eat meals, and we're in a beautiful setting. Very natural setting, and there's a very wonderful staff. They're providing us very nutritious, healthy vegetarian and vegan food every day. So, you know, it's quite wonderful. So what do we do? Actually, the first day or so, the instructions are to settle in. So we have the practitioners doing sort of the practices we did today, really settling into their body, settling into their breath, and just being mindful, just kind of arriving. You know, one can physically arrive at a place, and yet our minds can still be all over the place, right? So we want the first day for people to really arrive, body and mind, and be present, and really kind of create a barrier to the past and the future and their regular life. Why? Because they're on retreat. And the essential thing about retreat is it is an opportunity. For many of us, our study and our practice is unfolding in the context of a fairly active, busy life. So even though we may be meditating for 15 minutes a day or half an hour a day or an hour a day or 2 hours a day, reading, studying, the major part of our life is very different, very lot of stimulation, activity, and drama. And that kind of stuff often makes it difficult to really focus deeply on the teachings and doing the meditative practice and integrating them. And so to take 7 days where that's all you're doing and you can really focus all your energies in this direction of one's own understanding the nature of oneself, you know, is I think, very necessary for those of us who want to develop. Because it's not as if we don't want to and need to learn how to practice in our daily life. We are lay people. We have the full range of work and family and responsibilities, et cetera, et cetera. So the practice has to be integrated into our daily life so we can leave a good life. But the learning curve, the learning curve of getting there often involves this capacity. This is what we're doing this morning. Everybody here has stepped back from their normal life to spend a few hours focusing on matters to which we usually don't have much time to attend to in this concentrated way. We have days of mindfulness in our community. We have retreats. We have these intensive. These are all possibilities. So anyhow, so just spilled tea on the first page. But so first day is settling in, and then what do? We have people spend the second day, in addition to their meditation, to contemplating these basic teachings of Buddhism on impermanence. On that death comes to everyone, ourselves and everyone we know, that everything is constantly changing, about the law and cause and effect. So we learn why are things the way they are and how do they change, and a number of other basic contemplations. Why to do that? Because, you know, you're up at Southern Dharma, you know, you're practicing with 30, 35, you know, your friends, it's beautiful, the food is good. You know, it's like you could just kind of just enjoy just hanging out, you see. Because it's easy to forget, not remember what's really going on in this life. What's really going on in this world. The kind of lives that most people lead. The great need this world has for clarity and wisdom and compassion and understanding. And we often forget, you know, the things that are going on in our life. So spending the first day kind of doing this contemplative exercise is important because it gives us a setting for why we practice. It energizes us. It reminds us of these basic truths, right? And so we spend the first day contemplating this. So then by the second or third day, in this case at this retreat, I introduced a text, a practice text. So these are not study texts. These are short 2-3-page texts that are really meditations. And this one is called The Wheel of Analysis and Meditation that Thoroughly Purifies Mental Activity. So this is a text, and again, it's a preliminary text. And it really deals with helping people understand that their body and mind has no solidity, has no permanence. Right? Which is, for many people, that's a new concept. Right? Because what do we identify ourselves with? We identify ourselves. Who am I? I'm my body and mind. And we're very proud of it, or we're very not proud of it, or we like it, we don't like it, but more or less, we totally identify with it. We identify with our thoughts. We think we are our thoughts. We think we are our feelings. We think we are our stories. We think we are our memories of the past. These are all things we think are, this is who I am. So this wheel of analysis and meditation that thoroughly purifies mental activity is our practices that help us look directly into our body mind to see whether any of that is true. As it is said in the introduction to the text, whatever problems there are in the world are created by the afflictions in our own minds. A mistaken attitude is the cause for these afflictions, yet the pattern of our thoughts can be refined. Very powerful. We think the problems in the world are created by what? By them. You see, by them. Right? The problems in the world are created by them, and the problems in my life are created by all the other people in my life. See? That's the way we see it. So this is radical. Whatever problems in the world are created by the afflictions in our minds. People who have afflictions in their minds create affliction in the world, right? People who have afflictions in their mind create afflictions in their relationship. So, rather than looking out there to solve the problems, we are now on retreat looking into our own minds, right? And very hopefully, Nipam Rinpoche, who wrote this, says, yet the pattern of our thoughts can be refined. That's the optimism. That's the optimism. When something is refined, when an ore is refined, it is purified, right? It is purified of all of its contaminants. So its natural inherent purity can be experienced. And so he has us in the course of this text, the meditators are meditating on looking into their body, their feelings, their perceptions, therefore their consciousness. Look into their nature. Divide them into their various aspects. When you see them as insubstantial, like bubbles, a mirage, a banana tree, a magical illusion, you will understand how in these two there is nothing to which one could be attached. And again, that's another Dharma talk, but obviously in Buddhism, attachment is another prime cause of our unhappiness. We attach to things. We hold on to things. We want them to be the way we want. We don't want them to be the way we don't want to be. And yet, we're learning that these things that we're attached to are insubstantial, are impermanent. And look for what is what we call the I. Everybody know what that is? The I. And look for that which is called the I. When you see that like a waterfall, a shower of rain, or an empty house, the self is devoid of any intrinsic nature. Say to yourself, in the past, I would always get caught up in my mistaken ideas and attitude, which led to all kinds of useless speculation. But now I will consider only this instead. The more familiar you become with this practice of thorough training and investigative meditation, the more afflictions will diminish, the subtler your suffering will become, and it'll be much easier to practice meditation. So, again, at this level of practice, this is a preliminary to really learning how to meditate with a stable, calm mind. Actually, it's interesting. In his final paragraph, he says, and this was written in Tibet in 1891. He says, by virtue of this explanation, meaning this text he's written, may all beings tormented by the troubles of this degenerate age. This is 1891 in Tibet. Can you imagine what he would say if he was alive today? By the virtue of this explanation, may all beings tormented by the troubles of this degenerate age meet this elixir-like teaching on non-attachment, and through its power reach a state of perfect peace. What a wonderful wish. Now, in the retreat, I think sometime maybe in the evening of the third day, I introduced the text that we would be focusing on. And again, for those of you who listen to the talks on the website, you might have noticed that for the last couple of years, we have not recorded the talks on these types of retreat. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, because in these retreats, rather than just giving one Dharma talk a day, I'm actually in the meditation hall a lot more and are giving talks and instruction in meditation to the participants throughout the day. So it's not like it's just one talk. But also, this is about experience, you see. And it's very easy to listen to talks and to kind of hear it intellectually. But the context, you see, the talks are being given in the context of a retreat where people are practicing these teachings. And their minds are very receptive to these teachings. And oftentimes, these days, because of the computer and the internet and recordings, we're able to kind of listen to very, profound or deep kind of talks, sort of, you know, in the midst of everything else going on. You know, we're cruising around the internet. Oh, let me listen to a retort, a talk on this or that. Or we're in between this and we're running to that, but, you know, we have a little time. I'll listen to a talk. Again, that doesn't mean that that may bring some benefit to the mind, but in terms of actual integration, that way of listening to is, I don't think, all that helpful. You know, traditionally, these kinds of teachings were not transmitted by books. Were not transmitted by recorded talks. They were transmitted very directly between a teacher and their student. So there was a personal kind of relationship, right? There was a context in which these teachings and practices were given. Unfortunately, these days, that is more the exception than the rule, that many people now are learning practices, again, through the internet, through their reading, through attending retreats or things where, you know, the teacher doesn't know them and all they've had to do is sign up. So it's really unfolding, unfortunately, in a very different way in our culture. But that's the way it is. This text is a very wonderful text. It's called The Flight of the Garuda. It was written by this really extraordinary being who was called Lama Shapkar. He lived from around 1770-80 into around 1850, so not that long ago. But he was kind of from the old school. He spent years and years in retreat. He was one of these guys who lived up in the Himalayas, you know, at 14,000 feet, for years and years. So he was he was kind of a yogi type. But yet he was, one might say he was all heart. He had a great capacity as he wandered about to teach kind of ordinary people the Dharma and awaken people and inspire people. He actually lived in an area of Tibet that was where there was a lot of banditry and a lot of clan kind of fighting, so he was a great mediator of conflicts. In a society where meat eating was dominating, he was a very we might call him a rabid vegetarian. Unusual for his day, really saying anyone who practices a path that is about ending the suffering of beings has to be aware of the suffering that are caused to animals when they are eaten. So this is a text he wrote called The Flight of the Garuda. Now, the Garuda is a kind of a mythical figure in Hinduism. It's kind of a bird-like figure. But the unusual thing about the Garuda, as opposed to, most little chicks that kind of, you know, when they come out of the egg, they're like these little furry kind of things, and then slowly they develop, their feathers. Garudas come out fully developed, right? They have no, they don't go through any growth stages. And so the Garuda is really an analogy of our Buddha mind, of our true mind, fully formed. So he calls this text The Flight of the Garuda. And I'll just read a little bit from the first couple. And these are songs, by the way. He was also in the tradition of a great enlightened master who was also a troubadour. So he would spontaneously sing these songs of teachings. Now again, within the Buddhist tradition, which is a very large tradition, many, many different lineages and practices within it, there are these traditions that put primary emphasis on the capacity of each and every one of us in this lifetime to become awakened. And Shabkar is part of one of those great traditions, which goes back to the Buddha. You know that the Buddha's, when he was alive, Shakyamuni, 2,600 years ago, there was a very widespread yogic Vedic tradition in India that he was part of, and yet he felt that the realization, that the real ending of suffering had not been discovered. And so he devoted himself, as many of you know, to meditation. And in his, people think of a great awakening like as some kind of mystical thing, colors and, and all kinds of altered astral states. No. You can take drugs if you want that. To be awakened means you're awakened to the reality of how things really are. You're awakened to something, you see. And what you're awakened to is a transformative, radically different way of seeing things. So what was the Buddha's awakening? He said, wonder of wonders. I mean, this was what he was said to have exclaimed at his awakening. Wonder of wonders. Everyone has this pure nature, undefiled, beyond birth and death. He described his experience as sort of like, he said, all the walls of the house have collapsed. If you can think about, like, we're in a building, right? So we're sort of enclosed, right? And we can only see outside through windows. But if you could imagine all of a sudden all the walls and the roof collapsed, all of a sudden we'd see this vastness, right, of where we are. Now we think we're in a room. We don't see that we're really in space, right? That's not our experience. But that was his experience. All the confinements of self were just blown away in his great enlightenment. And in that, he was able to see the essential pure nature of his own mind. And he said, and this is profound, and I say it, I'm sort of belaboring it this morning because it is so foreign to our culture, even our religious culture, which is a more of a path of good works and good actions. You know what I mean? It's sort of like this, but this idea of an enlightenment and this idea that our own minds have this true nature, undefiled, pure from the very beginning, and that it is within all of us and can be accessed by all of us, I think is something that we are not aware of, are we? In our culture, people don't talk this way. People don't talk about this, do they? But this is really what the Buddha did. And even though in his 50 years of teaching in India, he taught all kinds of people with all kinds of issues, all his wisdom came from this profound understanding of knowing the nature of his own mind, the nature of reality. Because when you know the nature of your own mind, you know the nature of the minds of everyone. Because we essentially have this, we have the same mind. We have different thoughts, we have different experience. But the fundamental nature of our mind is in the same way, we're all sort of in this space. That's what unites us. We all may be different, look different, think differently, but we all share this space together. So, let me just give you an example. At a wisdom intensive, a wisdom retreat, and again, most of the songs have to do with practices, so I'm not going to go into them. I'm just going to give you a sense of the introduction. So he begins his song, song one. If there are any musicians here, you may think about orchestration. He says, I, the untroubled and carefree renunciant, he's talking about himself, will now sing this song about the view, entitled The Flight of the Garuda. It enables one to swiftly traverse all the levels in the paths. Listen carefully, fortunate children of my heart. So again, in traditional Buddhism, you know, there are many levels to transcend, many paths to practice. And he said, but I'm going to give you the view that transcends all of this. Fortunate children of my heart. And then he says, in both samsara and nirvana, samsara means the world of suffering, nirvana means the world of non-suffering. So it means in all the worlds, really meaning all the mind states of the world, the renown of the enlightened state. And by the way, a Buddha means one who is enlightened. That's all it means. So anyone who becomes enlightened has experienced their Buddha nature. And in a deep way is a Buddha at that moment. In both samsara and nirvana, the renown of the enlightened state is widely heard like thunder throughout the sky. He may be speaking more to his own culture. I'm not quite sure in our culture whether the renown of the enlightened state is widespread in our culture. But maybe in Tibet it was, which is wonderful. It's widely heard, how wonderful, like thunder throughout the sky. As this always remains, this is this enlightened state, as this always remains within the minds of all beings, how amazing that one is never separate from it for even an instant. So many of us, we feel so separate. We feel so disconnected from ourselves, from everyone else. We feel alone, right? That's often the way we really experience things. And we have to kind of do something to feel connected, to feel alive, you see? And he says, how amazing that this natural awakened state of mind, we've never been separate from it. To say we've never been separate from it has to mean what? It's right here, right now. Not knowing that this state is within oneself, how amazing that one searches for it elsewhere. Now, that has lots of meaning for us as Americans, because if we kind of put it in more mundane terms, we'd say people are searching for happiness. People are searching for peace of mind. People are searching for connection, right? But where do they search in our culture? Where are we searching? What? Yeah, we search in the world of acquisition. If I get more, then I'll be what? Happy, you know. And when I achieve my goals, then I'll be at peace. So we're always looking outside, accumulating, gathering, whether it's money, position, reputation, relationships, love. And then again, if that stuff doesn't work, we have lots of other opportunities, don't we? To find happiness and peace, right? We look to what? Drugs, alcohol, consuming, sex, hedonism. I mean, there's lots of things that we look to. You know, binge watching. There are so many things that we're doing. Why? If we ask ourselves, why am I doing this? Well, because I want to be happy. Or I want to feel at peace. I want to feel good. Right? I mean, that's what we want. That's normal. We want to feel connected. We want to feel at peace. We want to feel one with things, you see. But we don't know that that's already here. And that all this wandering and looking and searching is just taking us further away from. Now, knowing that the state is within oneself, how amazing that one searches for it elsewhere. How amazing it is in this culture of ours that those people who have so much are still what? Gathering more. It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like crazy. I mean, you already have enough. And yet what? Why this always acquisition? More, more, more. We can go all kinds of reasons, economic reasons, social reasons, but it's really deep down inside. It's this emptiness inside. It drives people never to be satisfied. It's got to be better somewhere else. And that's really, in our culture, unfortunately, you know, pervasive. Now, knowing that the state is within oneself, how amazing that one searches for it elsewhere. Although it is clearly manifest, like the radiant disk of the sun, how amazing that so few see it. Having no father and mother, one's mind is the true Buddha. How amazing that it knows neither birth nor death. No matter how much happiness and sorrow is experienced, how amazing that it is never impaired or improved, even in the slightest. How amazing that without being fabricated, the mind, which is unborn and pure, is spontaneously present from the very beginning. The self-awareness is naturally free from the first. How amazing that it is liberated by just resting, at ease in whatever happens. So this mind is said to be inherently pure. It is like the sky. It doesn't matter how many clouds move through it, light ones, dark ones, stormy ones, beautiful ones. The sky is never affected, is it? After the clouds pass through, after the hurricane passes through, after the lightning and the thunder, you know, the blue sky is always there. So it's hard for us to believe that with all we've been through and all that's going on in our mind, that somehow at its very nature, this mind is inherently pure. So that's why the practices are to help us reveal that. To who? To ourselves. So we know it. Butter is made of the essence of milk. But if the milk isn't churned, the butter won't form. Sentient beings are of Buddha essence. But if they don't practice, they won't be enlightened. So for those of you going, well, that sounds great, you know, just the last paragraph, all I got to do is relax and rest and I'm enlightened. Well, I like this teaching. Well, you know, it's sort of like somebody told you, you know, there's a pot of gold 50 feet under your house. Just knowing that doesn't make you wealthy, does it? You have to what? Dig it up. So knowing that we have this pure Buddha nature in all of us doesn't mean we've realized it, doesn't mean we live from it. That's what we practice. But then he goes on to say, anyone who practices this teaching will be liberated. It doesn't matter if one's intellect is sharp or dull. With practice, even a herdsman will gain liberation. Now, obviously, in Tibet in those days, I guess the herdsman was considered sort of on the bottom, you know what I mean? They're just a herdsman, they have no education. So, I don't know, you know. But basically, what does he say? Anyone, you know, because many of us think, well, you know, this Dharma, this Buddhist stuff, it's, I don't really get this emptiness stuff, this non-self stuff, you know. Right? It's really, I just don't get it. I'm not smart enough. Maybe smarter people can practice the wisdom path. You know, or else many people think, well, you know, I'm so contaminated, my mind's so scattered, my mind's so restless, you know, I have so many afflictions, anger and fear and jealousy, you know, maybe other people, but never me. But see, that's just the superficial. That's just the top layer. And so what he says, anybody can get this. I mean, they're wonderful in the teachings, wonderful exchanges with Shapka and other people, interacting with herdsmen and herds ladies. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, wonderful, wonderful interactions with these people where he actually brings them to enlightenment. He just runs into them in the mountains and he gives them these practices to do, and actually because they just kind of do what he tells them to do, you know, which again is another difficulty for us. You know, we like to do it our way. We think we know best. But there are these wonderful things where these very, you know, people who really, you know, don't have any intellectual understanding of Dharma and non-self come to realization, because what are they realizing? Their own minds. Which, as he says, even if you're totally uneducated, because your mind is of the same Buddha nature, you can realize it. With practice, even a herdsman will gain liberation. When you directly perceive the luminosity of your own mind, this is the essential purity of your own mind. There is no need to listen to theories about it. When you have molasses right on your tongue, you don't need to be told how it tastes. Even a scholar remains deluded if he hasn't realized his teaching. No matter how skilled she may be in discussing, well, it's the nine jhanas, all the teachings of Buddha, that's like describing a faraway place she's never seen. Enlightenment is further away from the sky than the sky from the earth, which isn't very far. Yeah, so any questions? I just wanted to give it. So for the next 5 days of retreat, everyone was given a copy of the text, and we really probably only worked on 6 or 7 of the songs, but they are all really meditations, looking directly into the mind, investigating it, probing it, and learning how to really rest in it. When you rest in your mind, you're resting in your relaxed, empty mind. You know, you could do that right now. So why don't you just, everybody, sit up straight for a moment. And just relax your mind. Relaxing your mind means you're not trying to do anything. You're not trying to meditate. You're not trying to stop thinking. You're not trying to do anything. Just relax your mind. And let it, just imagine it's just coming to rest. Sort of like something that kind of floats to the bottom, you know. You drop it in and it just comes to rest on the bottom of the ocean. Let your mind be at ease. Nothing to be concerned about. Nothing to worry about. Nothing to make any different than it is. in this moment, everything is perfect just the way it is. You don't need to change anything. You don't need to be a good meditator or a bad meditator. Just let your mind rest. And that means also just letting your thinking mind do whatever it wants. It's not you. Your thinking mind just generates thoughts. Stop identifying with your thinking mind. Rest the mind that is aware of it, that's aware of your thoughts. Just rest that. Through our eyes we see sights. Through our ears we hear sounds. Through our nose we smell. Through our mouth we taste. Through our body we sense. And through our thinking mind we generate thoughts, perceptions. But now we're talking about that mind that is aware of all that, you see. Can you just rest in that? Not identifying with all the activity that's going on. You're like resting at a still place within yourself. And you're just not identifying with anything that's going on. Your mind's at rest, you're at peace, you're at ease. In this moment, you have no issues, you have no problems. Those are all just generated by the thinking mind. Just for a moment, just give it all a rest. Come to rest. No need to do anything. Actually, we often find this practice hard because we want to do something. We want to make something happen. We don't really believe that it's all right here already. And I need to just let go so I can see it, experience it. There could be chattering going on in your thinking mind. You don't be disturbed by it. Let it chatter. You be at rest. Let everything just be as it is. Sort of like coming to ground, putting it all down. Good. Just so now, are there any questions about what was shared today? Please feel free to question, challenge. It's all good. everybody just too blissed out? Is that the problem? too much rest? But I'm serious. I mean, can you see, we tend to mystify kind of enlightenment, awakening, the spiritual path, like we mystify it into something that we need to do to get somewhere. When really, it's all about really coming home and really just simply understanding who and what we really are. That is why he says you don't have to be you could be a great scholar of Buddhism, you can have great you can be a great reader of Buddhism, and you could have great conversations. He said that doesn't mean anything. Right? So we want to plumb our own experience. That's why the practices of mindfulness are so essential. So we can learn to be attentive and present to what's going on within us, within our own body minds. There's no greater teaching that you'll ever receive more than watch your mind. Right? So again, I mean, if there really are no questions, that's fine, but just make sure that you see the practicality of this. You see the relevance of this. Because it really calls into question, because we are so identified with what? With our stuff, with self and its stuff. Its thoughts, its feelings, its emotions, its issues, its past, its present, its future. I mean, that's our whole concern. And to all of a sudden be told that it's all just a fabrication. And that all one has to do is let go. I mean, that's pretty radical. Yes, and then you. Yes. Kevin.
So much a question, observation.
Mm-hmm.
In the earlier text, you talked about the pattern of our thoughts can be refined.
Mm-hmm.
What my sense of that means that it inspires the sense of confidence of my to refine that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels accessible. Like a lot of times, myself, with that self, I think of it being out there, I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second.
So let me just, the first is really a comment how positive you felt when you heard that thing about the pattern of our thoughts can be refined. That so often, again, the path, the practice seems hard or it's out there, and you realize, no, it's our own thoughts that need to be refined. The way we see things that needs to be refined. That's what needs to be refined.
The second part, talking about the thoughts can be refined, that seems to sense that, again, it's accessible.
Yes.
And that both of those seem to, for me, call to say it's worth my diving deeper and looking in instead of always wanting to be figuring that out, or if I could just fix somebody else out there, then I would have some deeper understanding. But
right. Right, so Kevin's, for those who can't hear, Kevin's just also affirming that the second part, the flight of Gurdwara, which is a confirmation at a deeper level, that, again, you know, the way for me to untie the knots that bind me are within my own hands, within my own capacity, right? But I just need to understand the nature of my mind, the nature of thoughts. So, I mean, you know, I mean, we did a little exercise here, but this is a deep practice, learning to really rest in one's natural mind, really learning to see the empty nature of thoughts, your own thoughts, so you're no longer bothered by them or fooled by them, seduced by them. I mean, at this point, we're just all tossed about by our thoughts. Why? Because we think they're real solid things, right? At this point, we're all tossed about by our memories and our issues because we think they're real things, don't we? And to realize, you know, what are they really made of? I mean, what are your issues made of? Anybody here have an issue? I mean, what are your issues made of? What? Yeah, memories, thoughts, feelings. But what are these things? Are these solid things? You see, are they solid things? I mean, can you pull your memory out and what, you know, can you show it to me? Can you show me your issues? And people will go, what? They'll laugh. That's crazy. Of course I can't show you my issues. Why not? Well, they're in my mind. Oh, well, where are they in your mind? Well, I can't see them now. Well, then how do you know they're real? I mean, if you, right? I mean, if something's real, you have to be able to touch it, feel it. You know what I mean? You have to, right? If it's real. Or unless we've, if not, we've entered the world of the psychotic, right? Because the psychotic, what? All their thoughts and feelings are real to them, no matter how bizarre it is. That's real. So maybe we need to do a little mental health check on ourselves. Because there are many things that we think are real, solid, and that affect our behavior and our relationships that maybe aren't. But of course, as Kevin said, it takes the capacity to be willing to turn our minds and its awareness and its mindfulness and its capacity to investigate on something that's radical for us, which is ourselves. We're great at investigating everybody else. We're great at figuring everybody else out, aren't we? Oh yeah, we're just geniuses. We're just all mini Freuds here, you know? But when it comes to ourselves, you know, it's like, oh, it's like a blank. It's like unknown territory, you know? Anyhow, yes. The world what? The world the So the question is kind of acknowledging everything that's been said today, and yet what? And yet we look at our world and we see such suffering, and we see that there, you know, that there are people obviously who are very actively creating suffering for their fellow human beings. Yeah, that is the truth, isn't it? Now, this is our problem, you see. You know, it's how do you find that middle ground, you see? On the one hand, in the face of so much, not just, I mean, it's suffering, but so much delusion and so much egoism and so much stupidity. You know what I need to go on? You know, and greed and, you know, anger and violence, you know. In the face of that, one can either what? Go to one extreme, which is be overwhelmed and become indifferent, become callous, right? That's one extreme we can fall into. The other extreme is the extreme of the bleeding heart. We could just, you know, endlessly be responding to every situation there is, and yet at the end of the day, you wake up the next day and what? There's another whole slew of them. It doesn't seem to end, does it? And just when you think one crisis is end, or one war is ended, or, you know, one person has been outed, you know, all of a sudden the next day, now it's somebody, you know, it's about something else. You know, so why is that, you see? I mean, that's what we want to do. The same way that as individuals, we want to look into our own minds to see why we suffer or why we act in an unskillful or pain-producing way to ourselves and others. We want to, right? The same way we want to ask some deeper questions about why does this just continue on in society, right? Even though, you know, I mean, you know, forget about the Buddha. I mean, Jesus Christ, I mean, he has good teachings. Do unto others as you'd have others do unto you, or you're my brother's kid. You know what I mean? Like, you know, 2,000 years ago. What's the problem? You see? The world does not suffer from lack of good teachings. The world does not suffer from lack of good ideas, does it? No. They're endless. The world suffers because of the delusion of beings. And that even people who outwardly profess to these ideals actually, in reality, do not live them, do they? You know, so, you know, if we want to really, again, it doesn't mean we don't, you know, not respond to the suffering of people. Of course we want to respond. But we also understand if we want to end it, then it's about creating a different kind of person, begins with me, and a different kind of culture, different kind of society, where people are actually not just talking the talk, but walking the walk in terms of how they treat each other, how they take care of each other, right? And you know, it's easier to say it than do it. Yeah, so it's you know, how do you find that middle ground? You know, we can join every cause there is. We can wave every banner that needs to be waved. We can sign every petition that needs to be signed. And what? What's the truth? It's endless. Why is it endless? Because of, you know, people's minds, the toxicity of the culture, right? You know, we have to create a different kind of culture, you know, for us, for our children, for the people we work with, you know what I mean? There's got to be another way of living, another way of seeing things. And it can't just be based on theory, on ideas. It's got to be based on practice, you see. That's what's missing for so many people. They have good ideals, they have good things, but they can't live them. You know, they see that so many people are being harmed because of the anger of some people, and their response is what? To get angry. Right? Oh, you know, let me put some more anger into the world, some more hatred into the world, some more intolerance in the world. And somehow that's going to create a better world. You know, the Buddha said 2,600 years ago, violence will only end with nonviolence. Hate will only end with love. You know, it's like positive stuff. But if we don't learn how to love each other, I mean, and love, you know, it's easy to love people who are loving to you. You don't get any credit for that. You know, it's easy. You know, it's easy to understand people you want to understand. It's easy to accept people that you're accepting of, you know. But, you know, how do you love those that are hard to love, right? How do you accept people that part of you doesn't want to accept, right? You know, because don't you understand the problem? Whatever political side you're on, you can't accept that people see it differently, right? Unfortunately, over there going, they can't accept you. Right? Now, where's that going to end up? You know, so we have to begin to think a little more clearly here. Okay, anyhow. It's almost 12 o'clock. Thank you.